Number four, with Miss Gibb, of the Grove, Lazare, 28th February 1973. Very much like to know something about PMC Kermode, if you knew him, and of course Josephine Kermode Cushack.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, we knew Cushack really very well. Philip Kermode, I don't think he cared for women. Anyway, we were beneath his notice. But Cushack, well, of course, Sybil Payton, and I think she had been a nurse in her earlier days, and then she was crippled with arthritis and was a great friend of Fanny Rudd's, and both of them really, but Fanny particularly, who had this little phaeton built for her that she could easily get in and out of and drive about with a little pony.
Is that the one that is now in the museum?
Yes, where you took the whip.
Yes.
And they lived, you know, I can't think where they, oh yes, I think when old Mrs. Kermode was alive, they lived in that house next to the vicarage where Spencer Kelly was for many years, and the Harveys were there. If you go in from the vicarage,
yeah,
across,
yeah,
to some
Vernon Drive or
yes,
something.
And then when Cheryl went to live with the Browns, I think, in the Tom Brown's daughters in the south of England, he and Miss Josie moved into Clebane Old House. And he was so keen on getting the house. It belonged to Parson Harrison in those days, and he hadn't cared much about it, Mark's father. And Philip Kermode spent his time having it repaired and hunting Ramsay for an old chimney pot to match the rest. They were all original chimney pots, or anyhow very old, except I think it was the kitchen chimney, and it had had a new one put on, and it annoyed him intensely. And at last, in one of the back streets behind the church, he found a chimney pot that matched the others. So he went to the people and asked them if they would mind having a new chimney pot and letting him have the old one. And he would pay all the expenses, but he wanted to match up the chimney pots. And, oh, they were very pleased, only too willing to oblige him, and said a new one would be a very good thing. So they had a new chimney pot, and he took this up and had it put on. That was that. He was pleased about that. Then in one of the, I don't know whether it was a wash house or a back kitchen or what, but there was some place that had small panes, and it had two or three of these bottle bottom panes in, you know. When he had those taken and put somewhere else where they'd be more carefully preserved. And I'm surprised that the museum didn't go after that house when they thought of getting a place in Ramsay instead of thinking of taking this one. Mm. But they didn't, and I believe it's just falling to pieces.
Now, what sort of date are you talking about with Philip Kermode and his sister going in there?
Well, I think they moved in before the first... Could they have done before the First World War,
oh,
or just after?
So.
Yes, I think they did, before the First World War, because I think after that they moved to Douglas, because he wanted to be close beside the museum.
Yes, which was 1922, you say?
Yes.
And was Cushag then already a writer of her poems
at
this time?
Her little book was published before they left Ramsay.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they ever got another edition. It was sold out, and I don't think there was ever another edition of it. I know it was very hard to get one if you wanted one. Alice had one somewhere, but I have been unable to find it so far.
And were they first of all written for one of the newspapers, or did she just...
Yes, I think they must have been. But she largely wrote them for her own pleasure. And incidents when she went to see people or that kind. She went to see an old lady who was ill, and I don't know if she died or not, but in it, the old lady said, "Hoist me up a bit, Ginny, so that I can see Miss Kermode," or something like that. And she went home and wrote a little poem about it. Heist me up a bit, you see.
I must look that one up.
Yes.
Because Mrs. Quayle very kindly gave me a copy.
Oh, yes.
Inscribed, you know, for Stowell Kenyon with affection from M.A. Quayle, or Maud A. Quayle.
Yes.
And so I have a copy. Mm. So I must look that up.
It's somewhere in it, I think. Mm.
And when did Philip Kermode first start to take his interest in all the old...
I think he had always done. I don't think he ever did much as a... I think he was supposed to be a lawyer. I'm not really sure, but I think so. And he was always poking around for old books and old Manx things and this, that, and the other. He was, I think, always. Or at any rate, from the time is... the old man died. Mm. And of course, there were a lot of those Kermodes, because the old vicar of Mockle had been married twice, and Philip and Josie and Mrs. Haslam and another one, I think, were some of the first family, and Cheryl and Sapp. Well, they called him Sapp because his initials were S-A-P, so at King William's he got the nickname of Sapp. Sapp, he was always called Sapp Kermode. He was a parson, and he was vicar of Onchan, I think, for some years. And Cheryl, and he and Cheryl and... what was the other one? Not Rosemary. It was Rosalind. They were some of the second family, but there were more than that, because... now, what was it? Someone told me he'd had 10 children altogether. Mm. But there was another man, I don't know what he did. I think he went away of the first lot. I think he was William, and Philip, and Josie, and what was Mrs. Kermode? Mrs. Haslam's name. They went to Canada eventually. I've an idea she died before he and the son went. Gussie. What would her name be? They called her Gussie always.
Augusta.
Yes.
Yeah, Augusta.
Yes.
I think.
Well, they were four of the first. And Sapp and Cheryl and Rosalind were three of the second, but where the others went or came from, I don't know.
And did all you sort of younger ladies, did you all go and buy a copy of Cushag's poems, or did she give them you, or what?
Oh, you could buy them. You were there when the edition was published. You could buy them in the courier office, and they were very quickly sold out. Mm. And I don't think there ever was a second edition. I don't know, but I don't think so.
Hmm. What did they cost, you remember?
Because I know Alice, somebody said to Alice that they wanted one, and she said, Well, I won't give you mine. I'll lend it to you if you like. Mm. But I won't give you mine because I can't replace it.
No. Well, now, round about this same period, between the death of Queen Victoria and the First World War, of course, saw the beginnings of what are now the TT races, but the first one was motor cars, wasn't it?
Yes.
1904.
Now, awful excitement, the motor cars.
Was it the same course, Miss Gibb, as now?
Not quite, for they came along the... I don't know where they got onto it, but they came along the Derby Road and turned down into Ramsey just by St. Olive's Church there.
Oh, Lord.
They came along past Riversdale, the motor cars. Then when they took to motorcycling, they mapped out the course that they didn't come along the Derby Road, partly because it meant crossing the railway line.
I see. And did you go and watch the first motor car races?
Oh, yes. Oh, far too exciting not to go and see them. Because motor cars were very scarce in the island when they took that first turn round. I think we had them 2 years, I'm not sure. But I think they were twice.
And when they had turned down into Ramsey, did they then go up the mountain road?
Yes, they did.
Do they have to push them?
No, they chugged up, but some were very slow. Very. But they managed to get up. And they thought it was a great achievement.
Yes, indeed. It was a great achievement in 1920, never mind 1904. I have boiled many a time.
Yes.
And they only did that for 3 years, and then the motorcycles came.
Yes. I don't actually remember the dates of that.
No, I am right. It was 1904 motor cars, 1907 motorcycles.
Yes.
And
I think the motor cars were twice. And after that. And some people said the course was too difficult and too hilly altogether. Anyhow, they didn't want it.
No.
Though this last year, there were a great number. Now we counted, 20-something passing of these old cars.
Vintage cars.
Yes, they were. We had been to Poitiers, I think. I can't remember whom I was with. Oh, it was with the Australian, I think. And we came back round by Slough, and the motor cars were coming up from Castletown and going down by Slough. We hadn't expected to come in for this. And, well, we enjoyed looking at them, and she was consumed with laughter at some of them, funny little one with two people sitting high up, you know, in it, perched like on a thing, and it chugging along the road.
Mm.
I think we counted 30.
Can we move on to the First World War? Do you remember the declaration of war? August the 4th, 1914?
Yes, I do, and I was trying to remember where we heard it. I have an idea that it was announced from the balcony of the commissioners.
Could well be.
Because it was a very good place for speaking. I know, I think I heard Hall Caine twice, but the one time he spoke, I know, was from that balcony. And I think the declaration of war was given by the town clerk, who was then a Mr. Bell, I think.
And how soon did the island begin to receive aliens?
Oh, well, I don't know about that. Because, you see, there was a very large alien camp at between Peel and Glenmay.
Yeah, Knockalo.
Knockalo, that was it.
Were there any aliens in Rams in the First War?
I don't think so. I don't think there were any.
Because Knockalo had 30,000.
Yes.
They built a special railway line into it.
Mm. But, old Dr. McGay was one of the doctors in charge of the camp there. I don't know how many there were, but there were a good many, and they took it in turns, I think, because I have a basket that he gave me that was made by some of the prisoners of war, and they made baskets and things of that kind, and they were allowed to, the stuff was got for them, and they were allowed to make them and sell them. And he, I think, provided a lot of people with baskets. I know Alice had one, and I have one, and Sybil Moisey had one, and a lot of people. Mm. He bought them and gave them to you.
There was also, I think, a camp somewhere near Houstrake.
Yes, I think there was.
Because the other day I seem to have seen or given the museum or
yes,
a picture of this camp. It looks as though it's sort of where Cunningham's camp or something is.
Yes.
Or the Houstrake holiday camp.
Yes. Well, very likely there was, you know, because they thought it was a good, safe place to dump aliens because they couldn't get away easily.
No. Now, did they come out and work on the farms and that sort of thing?
Yes, they did.
Did you see any of
them? Those who chose to, they volunteered for work. And of course, I know quite a lot of them worked down the north here. They were brought down in lorries or some kind of a thing every day. Because you see, the young men here, there wasn't, for that First World War, there wasn't a man or a boy of suitable age left in Ramsey. The whole population had gone, of the youth and the men. There were a few that couldn't go, but I remember in the papers, Ramsey came second to one place in Scotland where there wasn't a man left in the village except one or two grandfathers, because the youth of the village was just old enough to go, and the other men all went. And Ramsey, men and girls, went. Alice went and worked in that munition factory at Chirwell, where they had that awful explosion.
Near Gretna Green?
Hmm?
Near Gretna Green and Annan?
No, down in Nottingham, near Nottingham.
Oh, yes.
It's now with Army Stores Camp. I've forgotten the right name. Mm-hmm. But it was a huge place. The wall around it, or the enclosure, was 12 miles, I think. And when they were starting it, what was the man's name, Lord? What was the man's name? Anyhow, he owned this land at Chirwell, and he'd been in India, and he was an electrical engineer. And at the time when there was T terrible shortage of shot guns and, you know, all that kind of thing. He had come home from India to see what he could do. And he said, I suppose it would be to Winston Churchill. Would it?
Yes.
If you'll give me a free hand, I'll be filling shells in 6 weeks. And they said, well, we don't believe it, but for goodness sake, get on with it. He sent to Australia for a man he knew, and to Canada for a man he knew, and someone who'd been with him in India he brought home, and someone from some part of America. And they set to work, and they advertised and sent the two Rolston girls from who their father was at, St. Jude's, and Alice, and Ruby Matthews was there for a while, and heaps of people. And they had a TNT place where they filled things, and they did. In 6 weeks, they were filling shells with no roof on, and the snow coming. And there were awful grumbles amongst the workers, but Alice said they turned up for work just the same. There was, and they put in some kind of, there was, the first, to begin with, there was an awful lot of toxic jaundice amongst them in the TNT place. And the doctors were at an awful loss as to how they could stop this. And they came to the conclusion the best thing to stop it would be baths. And that if the women would take a bath before they went out, and they all had to change their clothes when they came in, and before they put their own clothes on, they would be free of this powder rubbing into their skins. And in the end, they reduced it and in the end controlled it. There was no toxic jaundice. But of course it was an eye-opener to Alice, because she'd never seen such filthy people in her life. No. The scum of Nottingham and Derby and some other place were all coming and working there. The place was crowded out. And she said the lockers, where the women had a locker reach for their clothes. And she said, they were crawling. It was dreadful.
I can imagine.
And she said she had a bath before she went back to the hostel every night. And they worked day and night. They had 3 8-hour shifts a day, but the supervisors had 2 12-hour shifts. And they were nearly knocked out by it. In fact, at one time, I believe, when Alice got back to the hostel every night, she wasn't fit to go and have a late dinner, which the matron of the hostel provided. She went straight to bed and often collapsed on the top landing where her thing was. So, what was the girl's name? She stayed with us here afterwards, she said. And some of the others were just the same. They collapsed from exhaustion and lack of food, really. Mm. Because though the workers got 11s and a good meal in the middle of day, there was no provision for the supervisors. Mm. And this matron of the hostel had a good dinner ready for them at night. But some of them were too tired to have the dinner, you know.
12 hours is a very long time.
Yes. Well, anyhow, that was altered afterwards, and the hostel was given up because she ran it too expensively, and they got more pay and had to find their own. And one winter, Alice and this friend who came from the Channel Isles, they lived in a caravan. Alice said it was bitterly cold, you know, because it was a place where you get a lot of frosty fog. And they'd 6 weeks when you could hardly see your hand in front of you, and this frosty fog. And then afterwards she got rooms with a little woman in the village of Chilwell, and was very comfortable there. And the funny thing was that this little woman came to Douglas every year for her husband and her for their holidays.
And meantime, back in the island, I've heard it said that the shortage of food here was worse than England.
Quite likely.
I mean, you noticed it badly, did you? The shortage of tea and butter and...
Yes. Of course, in the Second War, things were rationed and people got a much fairer share, really.
Well, in the First World War, did you not have rationing at the end of the island?
No
rationing at all in the island? Because, of course, in England, rationing came in about 1917.
Yes. Well, no, it didn't really come here. I don't think we didn't have it at all in the First World War.
No.
We just got what we could and did without what we couldn't have.
Wrung your own hen's necks.
Mm.
And in one of the books that I've got, I see that the White Star liner, the Celtic or the Celtic, depending how you like to call her, was torpedoed and sunk off the Calf.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
Was it near in the Calf or a long way off? Or?
It was quite near, I think. It was when a storm had driven her and she got onto the Chicken's Rock or something like that.
Mm. And do you remember peace coming?
Pardon?
Do you remember the armistice?
Yes.
When did you do that?
Well, I was trying to think, was it in church we were told about it? We were all very thankful.
Were there big celebrations in Ramsey or no one to celebrate?
There was no one to celebrate, really. See, the people drifted home by degrees.
There were just the wives and the children.
Yes. I know that autumn, we didn't think the armistice was so near. And our cousin in Scotland had been terribly ill and had a very serious operation. And the doctors said, well, yes, she's coming round. She may live 3 months and she might live 6, but probably not more. So they wrote here and said that I'd better go and we'd have to get Alice home from the factory to be here with Auntie. I've forgotten how old Auntie would be then. She was over 80 anyway, because she was 98, nearly 99 when she died. And that was in 33. So Alice very reluctantly came home. We didn't know the armistice was quite so close that I think we would have made an excuse and said that they must wait another 6 weeks before I could get there. Because she was awfully put out at having to leave. And I went there and I was in Edinburgh for 6 months and she was getting better all the time. In fact, by the time it was time to go to the country where they had this delightful old place and farm, she was able to walk to Princes Street. We were in Northumberland Street. And that's a bit down the hill. Mm-hmm. And she went on getting better until it came to May or June. And she was so much better then. And Scott had got home on, he was in, Arabia, I think. He got home on compassionate leave, And George was coming home, and Willie's papers hadn't gone through. He didn't get home till the autumn. But anyway, they were coming home, and Scott was coming home. And so I thought that I could go home. They were needing me here for the garden and things. And I went to stay with the Ritchies on the way home at Moffat. And I hadn't been, I'd been there about a week and was thinking of going back, coming back here the following week. And a telegram came from Edinburgh, please return at once. Cook ill, gone to hospital. So back to Edinburgh I went and was there another month.
Oh dear.
So,
to change the subject again, I'd like to ask you about Red John Culey. First of all, you knew my grandfather, of course. Did you go to his funeral?
Yes. I did, Margaret Kermode. No, perhaps I didn't go to that. It was Miss Culey's she took me to.
But...
Yes, it was Miss Culey's. I didn't go to his funeral.
But Red John was vicar of Rush, wasn't he?
Arbury.
Mm. And then when my grandfather died in 1912, May 1912, Red John was made archdeacon, yes?
Yes.
And... tell me about Red John.
Oh, well, you know, he was an awfully clever man, both with his head and with his hands. When he was at Cambridge, he passed a little shoemaker's, one of the old-fashioned country shoemakers, you know, mended shoes, and made them if you wanted them. There was one in Poitiers, and dear me, made the first pair of boots I wore, and the second and the third, too, for that matter. And he thought, now, why couldn't I do that? So he went in to the man, and the man said, what can I do for you, sir? And Red John said, tell me how to sole a pair of shoes. The man laughed and said, you'd never do it, sir. Never. And he said, well, I think I could. So he went in and sat down, and the man gave him the tools and a pair of countryman's boots that needed soling, and told him what to do. He watched the man doing for a few minutes, and then he proceeded to work. And when he'd finished, he said, well, how's that? The shoemaker said, it's not the first time you've done that, sir. Honestly, he said, it is. Well, it would pass very well. He could do anything with his hands. If he'd seen a thing done, he could do it. And of course, he was awfully clever with his head. He got the Manx Church much more onto its feet in the finance way, because he knew what should be and what shouldn't be and so on, that kind. They said, really, he put the money matters in order.
When did he come to Andreas? When did he move to Andreas?
Well...
straight away, more or less?
Almost immediately. But of course, you know, he had a hard person to follow in Archdeacon Gill. And... Miss Culey was awfully good, and people liked her immensely, and she was really very good. But she didn't get the same amount of either respect or affection that Lucy and Emily got. She was always... of course, she hadn't had the education or anything like that, and she didn't. But she was always being told that Miss Emily did so-and-so. That's not the way she did it. Miss
Lucy. Very tiresome.
Oh, she took it all in good part. She was an extremely nice, very kind and extremely nice.
My memory of Archdeacon Kewley is a very tall man.
Yes.
With a very long beard, which was
very red.
Which was red when I first remember it.
Yes.
And a good deal of food on his clothing front.
He wasn't a bit careful. Miss Kewley did her best, she said, to keep him clean, but he wasn't a bit careful. In fact, the funny thing, he kissed me since he was one of Mother's trustees, and he kissed me since I was a small child, and I hated it. I used to turn my head like that.
Fewest bird's nest coming at you.
Yeah.
He spoke Manx, of course, didn't he? And he preached in Manx. Sometime.
Yes, he could. Mm. Oh, yes, he could. He was really was an exceptionally clever man. And very kind and very nice. When he was the curate at St. Paul's, at intervals he used to ask Auntie to bring us to tea in his rooms. He'd rooms in Waterloo Road, lived with a Miss Spranger. I don't know where she came from, because that's not at all a Manx name. But anyhow, he lived there, and she always provided a very nice tea. And we used to be taken down to tea there.
Now, when did he die?
Well, I can't quite remember, you know.
Because he was Archdeacon for a long time, wasn't
he? Yes, he was.
It was in the 1930s, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, I think so.
1935 or something like that.
But, of course, he retired to Castletown, and he died in Castletown after he'd given up being Archdeacon.
Oh, did he?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He retired to a little old house in Maloo Street, I think it was, that had belonged to his parents, I fancy.
Yeah. What was his family background?
Well, his father, I think, was a grocer.
In Castledown?
Yes. And he was a clever boy and took a scholarship to King William's. And then there, of course, he was a star turn. Mm. He was rather like Scott Reed. Exams were nothing to him. He just sailed through everything and anything at all that was put before him, he apparently couldn't cope with.
A perfect example of the good reasons for founding King William's.
Yes.
To make a boy of humble parents.
Yes.
Into a rounded, perfect man.
Yes. But of course, it wasn't very easy for him to follow the guilds, because, you see, the country people would say, ah, yes, but they were quality, you know.
They hadn't been quality very long. And, This is conversation number 5 with Miss Gibb of the Grove Lazare on the 7th of March 1973. Miss Gibb, Johnny Crellin has asked me to ask you to describe the old horse mill that I think is still in the grounds here and still in nearly perfect condition.
Yes.
And he said that if you could remember to describe how it worked, what it did, and how many men there were operating it, and all that sort of thing, that this would be extremely interesting.
Yes.
And also, when it was last used.
Well, it was last used, I think, I don't think it was used afterwards, though I remember Richmond had great ideas of using it one year just to see how it worked. That was last used as a kind of regular thing in 1897.
Good gracious.
That was the year my grandmother died. And people named Curfey were all in Ballacotia Farm in those days.
As an address.
And year after year, this man, John, I think he was, came with a pair of horses to work the mill. And the pair were attached to the one end of the lever, and Polly, the mare, Granny's little mare, was attached to the other end by herself. And once it was started, you see, it worked so easily that the horses didn't seem to be pulling or anything. They just plodded on round and round and didn't seem to affect them. They'd go on hour after hour. They start in the morning, and of course they stopped at 12 o'clock, and the horses were fed and watered, and they had an hour or perhaps 2 hours off, and then they continued again till 6 in the evening. And we used to go and get rides on the lever when it was going round. And our old man Corlett, his youngest boy, I remember so well, came up one day. He was younger than we were. Not very much, but he was. But he was a bit stupid. And I remember so well, he came in and he ran to the lever and sat down, and Curfey was as quick as he was, and he grabbed him by the back of the neck and his clothes and lifted him up and said, "You'll break your legs going that way." He got onto the wrong side, where the lever was going this way. He should have had his feet there, that the lever would drag him there, you see. Mm. But anyway, I've never forgotten that.
And what exactly happened then? What were they milling?
They were thrashing the oats ready for market, taking the straw off and the grain separated. And then there was a hand winnowing machine which oughtn't to have been sold when some of the things that were no longer needed after Granny died, because it was a the corn, the oats, wasn't ready for market till the chaff had been taken off. And after the thrashing was over, Corlett would spend a day or two turning the handle of this like a sort of ammonia, barrel organ.
Yes.
And the chaff would be flowing out at one place, and the clean grain all going into bags.
Was this
the first thing through the mill? Only took the straw off, you see.
I see.
And well, Corlett fed the mill, and Curfey drove the horses, and there was a man to hand the sheaves to Corlett, and there was another man to take away the straw to make the stacks, the straw stacks. And the straw, there's a sort of, it's tied up now, but it lies down, the thing with the strokes like that, and the straw flowed down it, and the grain came down underneath the mill further back.
Did the grain fall into sacks or onto the ground? Or?
They generally put sacks, I think, and filled sacks with it. Mm-hmm. And then there was a man who put the sacks there and took them away and put another one.
So five men?
Yes.
And then those sacks went from there to the barrel organ.
Yes.
chaff machine?
Yes.
For the final threshing?
Yes. I often wonder who bought that and where it went. But it really should have never have been sold, because it was the finishing part of the thing, you see.
What did it look like? Was it about as high as you are, and a little bit like an old-fashioned wringer insofar as it had a handle?
Yes.
And then a big metal hopper at the top, in which you put
the grain
in at the top.
Yes, and it came out.
And coming out at the bottom.
It came out at the bottom, and the chaff sort of flew out on the way down. There was, I think, a sort of slit across it somewhere, but anyway, the grain was free of chaff, and the chaff was flying out and making a good heap outside. Mm-hmm. I often wonder who bought that. I suppose, probably, if they could be bothered and haven't burnt them, the crystals of that day would know.
It was auctioned, was it?
Auntie wasn't very, very wise about these things, and she didn't care very much, and she was speculating, could she, with her share of everything, could she manage to buy over this place from the rest of the family, because, like me, she'd lived most of her life here.
Yeah.
And didn't want to leave it.
Yeah.
But I don't think she ever realized what it meant, however. She was very happy. And that was a great thing, and she was, until she died. And she lived to be 98.
Not bad, is it?
No.
Going back to the mill, did you just thresh your own oats?
Yes.
Or did you do for other people as
no,
well?
No, just our own.
And how many acres did you have then?
Well, you see, I think they were divided into five of the fields in those days, and they were cropped in rotation. And it was the green crop, and the hay crop, and the grass field for the cows, and oats, and barley.
What size then was the...
Yes.
What size was the farm attached to the grove?
Well,
what acreage?
There was about 12 acres.
About 12?
It never really was supposed to be a farm. It was what a little book we had on the place, 3 acres and a cow kind of thing.
Yes. So that this mill was a bit of a sort of luxury for...
Yes.
Presumably you could thresh all your oats in what, 1 day, 2 days?
Yes.
So these five men came, and in 2 days they were gone, and the mill stopped again until next
year. Yes. Well, you see, you couldn't do the oats and the barley in the same week. They were here to do the oats, and then they came back another week, and the barley was ready.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've forgotten which is right first. The oats, I think.
And what date was the mill put in, and who put it in? Did your grandfather put it in?
Yes, it was put in... I don't think it was put in till 38, the year they first came here. I don't think it was put in 37. And it came from Scotland, and the flags on the floor of the mill came from Scotland.
Did they?
They all came in a ship.
What part of Scotland? What part of Scotland?
I couldn't tell you that. I suppose it'd be Glasgow, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Most likely. Was it a Swedish man? We've had ever so many people here to look at it from various places. I think the last was a student from Sweden, but I'm not sure whether he was the last or not. I think it was. And he had been in Scotland looking at some old mills. And when he came here, he looked at this and he said, oh, this came from Scotland. I said, well, I didn't know. Oh, yes, it did. He said, and the flags have come with it from Scotland. They're not Manx flags. And I said, no, I know they're not, but they're not like Manx flags, but they're... Oh, he said, that all came from Scotland.
So that basically, your grandfather, very shortly after he'd married, first of all buys this small house, then he builds a big house around it, and then he sort of mechanizes the farm.
Yes.
And this is about it, isn't it?
Yes. Well, you see, he was married in 1830, and he must have been extraordinarily lucky, because I believed he arrived in Liverpool as a young man, perhaps aged 17 or 18. I think he had got a job through a newspaper or somehow or other there, because his home place was in the country somewhere near Greenock. And his father had died, and I don't know how many of them there were. His mother wasn't well off, and he thought this was a good job, and apparently it was. I think it was with some of the Rankins, but I'm not very sure about that. But John Rankin, I think, said it was. And so that, of course, the best of everything came from Scotland.
Mm. And how much of the mill is there now? How much is missing, if any?
Well, as far, of course, it's very rusty, but all the machinery is still there, and most of the woodwork is still, all the woodwork except the table for the sheaves, or shelf, rather, for the sheaves, is there. The ladder-like thing, it's tied up, but you put it down and the straw comes flowing down it.
The ladder is still there, is it?
Yes.
And that came onto a table, did it?
No, the straw, you put the sheaves, the man there, like, put the sheaves on this table with a pitchfork, he'd throw them up. Corlett would take it and cut, oh, I think the man, no, I don't think, I think Corlett cut the band, or undid, and then he'd spread it out like this and feed it into the mill.
Yes.
And the straw would go out at the other end, and the grain would drop down.
Mm-hmm. And what is the missing piece, then?
This table that held the sheaves.
Oh.
And it was on a hinge, and when it wasn't in use, it lay down flat. And when it was in use, you pulled it up, and there was a big hook that you shoved in, and it kept it firm. I mean, any child or that could have sat on it quite happily, and it would have held them.
And equally, it would be very easy to put a new piece of wood.
Oh, yes, it wouldn't be difficult to do that.
So, I mean, it could be restored completely by just one piece of wood.
As far as I know, there's nothing else missing. And the student, the Swedish student, poked round and had a lantern, and or he had a, I think he borrowed the lantern. And he looked in at it and he said, there's nothing missing, but of course it's awfully rusty.
Mm. Yeah, anything missing is two horses and one pony.
Yes.
Yes.
John, this man Kirby, John Kirby, was such a nice man. I can see him now with his whip walking up and down on the lever, keeping his two... his pair level, you know, that one shouldn't shirk behind the other, Polly didn't need anything. She was a grand puller, as they said. I think Corlett had the little window open. I think he'd have shouted if anyone had dared to use a whip to Polly.
Very good.
Poor Corlett.
Mrs. Balakotia Andrus, was it? There is a Balakotia in Andrus.
I suppose there is, but this is a, this must be Balakotia there, because it's up behind Bolivia.
Oh, yes.
And young Cannell has it now. Curfee only rented it, because the owner had died, and the nephew to whom it went, now what was their name, was in Peel. And then eventually, the nephew and his two sisters wanted to come and live at Balakotia, so Curfee had to get out, and he got a